Hi, I'm Renee.
And I'm Anthony. We are the voices and founders of Blue Soul Earth, where we teach and we lead workshops and retreats about heart-centered living and unity consciousness.
Welcome to Blue Soul Chats, a podcast that bridges science and spirituality. We combine esoteric wisdom and the experiences that people have had for millennia and beyond with the latest breakthroughs in science, health, cosmology, physics, and the arts.
In each episode, you'll tune into cutting-edge visionaries who are making a powerful dent in consciousness from different industries and cultures around the world.
Our interviews cross boundaries and at times break conventional thinking as we redefine what reality is, what spirituality means, and what consciousness does.
Your journey to connecting to your higher self, expanding your awareness, and deepening your consciousness starts here.
Welcome, welcome everyone. We are sitting here with Dawson Church, whose work we love and we've known about for a while. And we're going to chat about consciousness. We're going to chat about genetics. We're going to chat about emotions, biology, the brain, and everything in between and anything else that Dawson wants to cover. So before we get started, I'll just give you a little bit of background about his work. Dawson is a researcher and the author of several award-winning science books. His best-selling book, Mind to Matter, demonstrates the connection between our inner thoughts and outer reality. And then The Genie in Your Genes, I don't know who came up with that title, but it's brilliant. This was considered a breakthrough in our understanding of the link between emotions and genetics. And then his more recent book, Bliss Brain, which I couldn't put down, shows how elevated emotional states shape the anatomy of our brains. And what I personally loved about it, and Anthony and I have talked about it because he's a much better meditator than I am, the book connects the dots between meditation, the scientific data from the clinical trials, and how easy it is to rewire our brains to get to that blissful state, which for people who have a harder time to meditate is amazing. So he has applied this data to achieving optimal health through EFTUniverse.com, which is one of the largest alternative medicine sites on the web. And also he's the founder of National Institute for Integrative Healthcare. And of course, we know that you currently lead retreats and events as well and courses. So we'll talk about that later. But before we even get there, let's rewind the clock a little bit, shall we?
Wow, that's an awesome superpower, Renee. Let me watch you do it.
That's an amazing bio, isn't it? I mean, it's an amazing bio. Thank you for being here with us.
Oh, I just love connecting with two of you, and it's a privilege to be here. Thank you for having me.
Before you went down the rabbit hole of linking the brain to manifesting material reality from a scientific point of view, what was there a catalyst that set you on this path? And if so, what was it?
Abject misery, totally toxic depression. When I was a kid, I had a pretty rough childhood. And by the time I was a teenager, I just wanted to not be here. And so I just thought about committing suicide. I was so depressed that people literally couldn't stand to be around me. Like people would like move 10 feet away. I invented social distancing as a teenage kid. So really, I mean, I was just so miserable. And most people, there's a famous line, I think from T.S. Eliot, that most men lead lives of quiet desperation. And everyone in my family did. Everyone, my father was a minister, pretty much everyone in church did. All the churches we went to did. Religion clearly wasn't the answer. So I wanted to try and escape my own misery. And I began to study spirituality and the perennial philosophy, Aldous Huxley, Alan Watts. I went to go live on an ashram as a teenager. And so I really got into trying to find answers there. And I got a little bit better, but there was just all this weirdness in the spiritual community. I mean, all these forms of emotional abuse and a lot of very damaged, wounded people there who'd fled real life. And so I then thought, well, spirituality not really doing the trick. How about psychology? So I enrolled for psychology classes. And, you know, if you've been involved in therapy for in the world of therapists and therapy for a while, you'll know that a lot of therapists also are choosing that profession because out of their own wounding. So I got a bit better over the years, did a lot of gestalt therapy and study therapy. But then eventually I made the commitment when I was 45 years old, I was in a real crisis. I said, I'm going to meditate every single day without fail. And from that moment onward, my life began to change. Within about a month, my money situation began to turn around and my relationships, I had two small kids. I was a single dad at the time. My relationships with my kids began to improve. Everything began to change. And then I got into energy psychology and problems, Renee, that I'd had for literally 30, 40 years and I had not been able to get away from, or not been able to heal through spirituality or psychology, suddenly they were just crumbling. And I found myself becoming happier and happier and happier. And then I began to research it. I said, what's going on here? So I helped form research teams. I worked with colleagues in various universities. We put together initially very simple clinical trials, eventually very elaborate ones, then randomized controlled trials, then MRI and gene trials. And I wrote the book, The Gene in Your Genes, around 2004, 2005, because I realized that all of these changes in consciousness had to be producing changes in gene expression. And so that was my big intellectual breakthrough, is realizing that was true. Published the book, became a bestseller, did a ton of keynotes and conferences, and just went on from there to realize that we can be incredibly happy. We can literally live in these blissful, elevated states. That's how actually we're born as babies, with that ability to live happily. The average baby laughs 300 times a day. The average adult laughs 20 times a day. Somewhere we lose 90%+ of our laughter. And so I want to teach people to laugh, live the lives of the mental lead, be in touch with those wonderful sources of consciousness we touch in meditation, and then live that as a joyful life. So that's been sort of the trajectory of the last almost 70 years.
Starting, you know, not really starting to have that, you know, serious catalytic moment until about 45, which is pretty profound, right? I mean, it's like, okay, I need a wake-up call, universe. Give me something. Throw me over the end of the bus, right? Just to kind of get you to say, okay, I gotta figure this out.
Absolutely. And you can figure it out. And it's nice to figure out when you're 15 or 25 or 35. But the interesting thing is that there's some research on people who figure it out at 45 or 55 or even 85. And it's interesting that they don't have any regrets. They don't say, I'm 85 years old. I wish I'd figured this out when I was 25. People, when they enter that state of equanimity, which in my book, Bliss Brain, we study it. And I mean, this is not just a happy state. We're talking about hard science over here. We're talking about epigenetics. We're talking about the anatomy of your brain, the functional connectivity between parts of your brain. And these people are, by these independent objective measures, are incredibly happy. They are in this elevated state. And then when they do it enough, when they inhabit that state long enough, they then turn that state into a trait, and then they are dispositionally happy. And they never seem to regret it not happening earlier in their lives. If it was 45 or 85, they're usually just pretty content to just be in that space. And it's also a very present moment space. So if you're there, you're in the present moment most of the time. And then that is your connection point to infinity, rather than being too worried about the past or the future. So whenever it is you're motivated to discover this and move into those states, you have a sense of real peace about however your life was, whatever tragedies and disasters you may have experienced. You come to this point of such complete peace that you're fine with all of it exactly the way it was.
Yeah, I mean, that's the famous age-old quote, right? Start where you are. And be okay where you are, right? For in that present moment, every single ancient sage, mage, and spiritual seeker, teacher, right, across cultures and time, talks about that power of the present moment. When we're in the present moment, you know, I don't know about you, but it's impossible, if you think about it, it's impossible to be angry, upset, you know, in fear or whatever when you're in that present moment. So for listeners who are new, I mean, there's people who are viewing into this are certainly not new to the world of consciousness and spirituality. You want to give a, you know, just an overview of what that is and why some of the findings that you found through your research is so pertinent to us today.
Well, when Crick and Watson discovered the double helix structure of the DNA molecule and then won the Nobel Prize for doing that, they drew it as a closed loop. And so there was the information in DNA. It produced proteins. Proteins produced everything else. And then that was the source of all information for life. It was this closed system with DNA being the foundation for everything our bodies did, both anatomy and physiology. And then a few experiments in the 80s and 90s laid open some cracks in that theory. And now we've had literally, by about 2010, we had hundreds of experiments showing that other things affect gene expression, not that all the information is in the gene. And so what I've done in my research, well, my first big study was of cortisol. And I was comparing 1 hour of talk therapy, regular therapy, to 1 hour of just sitting in a clinic doing nothing, to 1 hour of energy therapy, EFT, acupressure, tapping, where you're tapping on acupuncture points. And we just did 1 hour of this with people, and we discovered that there was a huge difference in their levels of anxiety and depression after that hour. Their anxiety and depression in the energy therapy group dropped twice as much as the talk therapy or rest group. Their cortisol plummeted in only an hour. So here we had a change in energy, change in consciousness, change in spiritual and emotional state, literally producing a change in our body's primary stress hormone. That's epigenetics. That's having an effect on gene expression and then subsequent molecular synthesis that is due purely to consciousness. If I get all stressed and worried and my heart rate changes and my breathing gets shallow, I'm pumping out more cortisol, I can do that in response to something really objectively bad that's happening in my life, like maybe there's a drunk driver in front of me. I'm driving down the road and there's this guy weaving in and out of traffic in front of me. That's a real danger. So I now have a rise in cortisol. But I can sit here later in the day, I can think about the drunk driver and raise my cortisol purely with consciousness. And the corollary is that if you learn that you're doing that all the time, and you are, every negative thought is producing shifts in your body, you can use your consciousness for positive epigenetic change. So epigenetics is the science of what changes gene expression, what turns genes on and what turns genes off from outside the gene. It turns out that all kinds of things do this. Diet does this. Exercise does this. The food you eat is doing this in your body all the time. It's epigenetic. But the factor that's your biggest leverage point over gene expression is up here. In one recent study, just a stunning study, got a lot of PR, was on Alzheimer's disease, which is a strongly inherited disease. If you have an Alzheimer's gene from your father and your mother, and you get these two genes, there are four flavors of this gene. If you get this gene, apogene 4 from your mother and your father, you have two apogene 4s, you have a 90%+ chance of getting Alzheimer's. If you have an apogene 3 and an apogene 4, then about a 70% chance. So strongly inherited disease, like a lot of diseases, like a lot of cancers are strongly inherited, heart disease is strongly inherited. And so this study showed, it looked at people's buildup of beta amyloid plaques in people's brains, which are the gooey, tarry, sticky stuff that stops neural communication, results in Alzheimer's, and results in brain shrinkage and eventually death. So they looked at people's levels of Alzheimer's plaques. And they looked at smoking, they looked at lifestyle, they looked at diet, they looked at every conceivable factor, including the apogene, and they found that one thing predetermined your chances of Alzheimer's more than anything else, and that was negative thinking. If you thought negatively, if you're predisposed to negative thinking, you had a quicker buildup of Alzheimer's plaques in your brain, and the more negative thinking, the faster the buildup in those beta amyloid Alzheimer's plaques in the brain. So thinking consciousness has a direct epigenetic effect on our bodies, which is why I'm so keen on sharing things like meditation, EFT, grounding, time in nature, love, just hugs, just caring about yourself, caring about other people. Compassion is profoundly epigenetic. So all these things are not just to make us feel better, they're making us live way longer and much healthier lives if we implement them in a practical routine in our lives.
Well, I mean, you know, all I can feel more than think when you say that is it's about time, right? I mean, it's about time that we make the link. We've known it since the power of positive thinking came out in the 1970s and even before, right? But we've not had the scientific data or the clinical trials to really give it the credibility.
Yep. You know, when I hear you speaking, I think it's pretty amazing how you have mentioned that you were so depressed and you were looking for a way to find who you are in this lifetime. And it wasn't until you sat and you started to meditate and you meditated and you meditated and you meditated and then something happened. What was that, Dawson, that turned that switch?
The trigger.
What was it through your meditations that you started to realize that you can be happy and that you don't have to be in depression? And what did you connect to something outside of yourself? Did you connect to yourself? What was it exactly?
Because that was way before all the data, scientific data.
Yes. Oh, this was in 2000s. This was a long time ago. And there wasn't all this research back then. I was in a whole different profession back then. And so what you do is you meditate consistently. And what I said was I'm going to meditate every single day. And it was kind of painful because I had these two young kids. I had to get up early to take care of them, get them to school. But I did it. I got up an hour earlier and I meditated. I didn't feel a lot going on initially. But I then saw these outside parts of my life begin to change. And so that's what you do initially. You just be consistent. And then things start to change on the outside. After a while, where this really showed up for me was my journals. I had been keeping a journal since I was 15 years old, and I had a whole, literally a bookshelf full of journals. And if you're 35 years old and you've been keeping a journal for 20 years, it's really interesting to read the journal from 5 years ago and 10 years ago. And it's very depressing to do that if you aren't able to change effectively, because you read about your suffering 5 years ago and your worst suffering 10 years ago, and you realize, except for the dates, nothing much has changed in your life. Mm-hmm. But after I meditated, I noticed that my journal began to change. And nowadays, my journal is just full of every positive idea I've had, every creative thought. And they're just this record. You actually, if you read my journals now, they're not meant for anybody else to read, but they're all about these just vibrantly wonderful experiences of infinity. And so you start to have a relationship with something greater than yourself. And you start to get out of your local mind and local worries. In Mind to Matter, I talk a lot about local mind and non-local mind. And we need to have local mind. We need to be able to, like, I'm just registering my vehicles at the DMV, Department of Motor Vehicles, this week. And that you need a local mind to do. Being infinite intelligence isn't going to help you register your car. So you got to have an ability at local mind. I was wearing a really ratty looking warm shirt before the interview. I went and changed. Local mind is so handy for things like making sure I have a nice shirt on now to talk to you. So that's all local mind. But if all you do is stay stuck at this lateral level of local mind, you're only experiencing a tiny just fraction of what it means like to be human, because the brain in Mind to Matter, I talk about how the brain is not the creator of consciousness. There's no evidence of that in science at all. And there is plenty of evidence that the brain is a receiver and transceiver of consciousness into local. So you tune into non-local. And I was doing that every day. I was tuning into non-local. I was feeling much happier. I was feeling connected. Also in Mind to Matter, I have studies showing that your problem-solving ability dramatically increases, your creativity dramatically increases, and your productivity increases. You're a much more creative and productive person in the outside world, so your outside world starts to get much better. And what I now know is happening, I mean, that was a long time ago that I was doing that and having the experiences, but I now know that the missing piece in most meditation research is we don't fully appreciate how much successful meditation and life change depends on anatomy. And there are certain circuits in our brain. There are four of them I lay out in my book, This Brain. Those circuits have to have enough neural bulk for us to be able to reach a tipping point where we're able to access those states at will. And until we build up that neural tissue and we build it up by practice, until you build up enough of that in these four circuits, you don't have enough of this neurological mass to have these elevated states. So what I was doing back then, all those years ago, I was meditating enough to gradually build up material. Some parts of the brain, like this part called the dentate gyrus, when you meditate effectively, that part of the brain is growing by about 10% a month. And that helps you regulate negative emotion, anger, frustration, blame, shame, guilt, resentment, all of that stuff. So you now have this neurological hardware that helps you do that. And so meditators build that neurological hardware. They simply have enough mass in those parts of the brain to reach this tipping point where you start to have a much happier life and the process then accelerates. So I reached that tipping point, not knowing I was doing it, but consistently took me there. And I now know from my research that I built enough mass in those four circuits to reach the tipping point and to then just flip into this awareness of altered reality.
You know, it makes me think of, you know, what some spiritual sages, ancient and modern, really call this resonance field, right? So when you're in this resonance field of love or this resonance field of compassion or empathy, right? I mean, it's almost, are you sort of referring to coherence in a way where it gets to a certain point where like our energetic bodies are in complete coherence and they're aligned with the all, right? They're aligned in the biofield.
I looked at this when I was writing Mind to Matter. I was really, really aware of people in my life. Like I'm friends with people like Jack Canfield and Joe Dispenza, and I'm struck by what amazing manifestors they are. Like Jack, if he wants to manifest something, you can bet on it. It's going to happen. And then I've known people, I have a fictitious name for this woman, but she's a real woman in Mind to Matter, that I call her Doris or something like that, but she's somebody I knew really well. And she has a brilliant ability to imagine positive outcomes and great things. And nothing that she focuses on or tries to manifest or has on a vision board, like nothing, none of it ever manifests. And I said, how does Jack Canfield do this effortlessly? And then Doris tries to do it, has a vision board, has her affirmation cards. And literally, I mean, I just saw Doris over years manifest none of her dreams. And so what I found now, hooking people up, and I've looked at some of my studies have literally hundreds of EEGs, is that the Jack Canfields and Joe Dispenzas of this world have coherent brainwaves. I hook them up and their brainwaves are all coherent. If you look at the squiggles on the screen, they're all marching in step. And they're not only are they coherent, they're coherent with each other. Because if I'm coherent here and you're coherent there, and we're both coherent with the universe, and again, the study, the research in Mind to Matter about this universal coherence is absolutely remarkable. The researchers at HeartMath have looked at people's individual heart coherence, matched it with huge cosmic cycles, sunspots and solar flares, and the solar wind passing by the Earth and changing the Earth's electromagnetic field. And those are in coherence in people who are in heart coherence, who are meditators. They are in coherence with these large fields. We're all in coherence with each other. If you hook up a Doris to an EEG, you find the squiggles don't match. They're all over the place. They're just not in coherence. So she has the will, the intention, she is visualizing, she's affirming without coherence. And so coherence is absolutely essential to manifestation. Manifestors are in the state of coherence, and people who have struggles with manifestation are not in coherence. So you have to learn to move into coherence. Now, meditation, actually, most forms of meditation, like I talked to Roland McCready at HeartMath, he said to me in 2009, he said, we've been hooking meditators up to heart coherence monitors. And when they go, when they start meditating, they drop out of coherence. So I then designed a meditation called eco meditation that that includes coherence. So people do some mindfulness, some neurofeedback, some tapping, and they do some coherence exercises to get into coherence while they meditate. And that meditation is enormously effective. It takes people to really advanced states quickly. So you have to be coherent. And a lot of meditation, forms of meditation, actually will drop you out of hard coherence. So coherence is the principle of the universe. Resonance is how our cells talk to each other, how cells from different parts of the brain communicate with each other. It's how we communicate with each other invisibly, with animals, with nature. Resonance and coherence are fundamental to the universe.
You know, it's interesting you're talking about the resonance field. Of course, you know, I'm a channeler. And I got all of the biggest change that occurred to me was through my meditation practice. When I had nothing left in my life, the only thing I could do was sit and meditate. And that's all I did every single day. And I believe it was through my meditations that something happened. But you seem to be explaining exactly what happened. I don't know how I got there. I have no idea how it happens. But I do know that it was through my meditation practice that I was able to become, I would say, more coherent in my life. And through this coherence, it did bring me a sense of something greater than myself. There was something bigger than me out there. I just didn't know it, but somehow I found it. And it was through this resonance field, this coherence of bringing me into this universal idea that we are all connected together.
And the non-local consciousness.
Yes. My local consciousness was here, but then when I channel, it expands outward.
And then you mentioned, Renee, compassion and love and gratitude and joy. And so, Anthony, when you're resonant with all of those things, you're resonant with everyone else is resonant with them. You're part of this huge field. And that's the commonality we find to people who are triggering big changes in their brains is they're aware of these fields, the one with the universe, the one with the cosmos. They're letting go of their local self. Mm-hmm. They're in the present moment. They're resonant with these fields. And then they're part of something greater than themselves. And then everything about their lives is also in resonance with that. So your life just is enormously easier and smoother when you're in that space.
I do believe, and I can say this from my own experience, that it is through meditation and through this way of seeing yourself that does literally change
the blueprint
of who you are in this lifetime.
That's actually what Joe Dispenza talks a lot about. And he even does exercises. I know you have similar exercises, right, that you do to get the body and the brain into this state of coherence. Can you speak to some of the exercises that people can do leading up to reading your book? Because this does not get you guys out of reading Dawson's book, but just to get people started, what can they do?
There are several practices that are really effective for meditation and also a lot of practices that aren't. And so what I wanted to do in this brain was I wanted to tease them apart and see what science shows us. And so I asked some really simple but tough questions like, how long each meditation session do you need to do meditation to have an effect? And you talk to meditation traditions, and they'll say it has to be an hour. Others say, oh, no, 5 minutes is enough. Well, which is it? Is it an hour or 5 minutes? You know, what is it? I entered writing the book, This Brain, agnostic. I had no idea. I had no axe to grind. And so I just asked questions like that. How long do you have to meditate before you start to see an effect? What styles of meditation? So in the book, I cover 7 styles of meditation. They're very different kinds of meditation. For example, some people love sitting quietly. Others like having something active, like counting your breaths or reading inspirational literature. Some like yoga and qigong and tai chi and movement types of meditation. So what does science tell us about each one and which one's best? And so you want to pick practices that work for you, but you want to pick evidence-based practices. And a lot of the stuff out there is just window dressing. It doesn't really move the needle in terms of EEG and MRI studies. And that was my standard. I said, is there an EEG or an MRI study? is there an evidence base that shows this meditative practice works? And 99% of the stuff out there, there's no evidence showing that it works. And a few things, there's good evidence that it works. So just do those things. One very simple one is slowing your breath. We know from research that if you slow your breath, some like heart math says 5 seconds per in-breath, 5 seconds per out-breath, that'll get you started in my method called eco-meditation, which is a combination of all these best practices. I have you do 6 seconds in, 6 seconds out. Andrew Weil says do a box breath, which is breathing in slowly, holding, breathing out slowly, holding, breathing in slowly. So it has 4 cycles. That's even better. People can go to 10 counts and then 20 counts per breath. So slow breathing definitely helps. I mean, it sends a signal to the vagus nerve that has you just relax. So we know things like that are evidence-based. And with eco-meditation, we just string them all together, say, do these 7 effective ones, and then you'll automatically drop into this space. So we've had tons of people email us and write to us and say, I tried this combination of these 7 methods, and they just work. I've been trying to do it for a long time. I've been trying to get this place of inner peace. Nothing was really being effective. Like one Iraq veteran called Bryce Rogo wrote me this long, like 4-page letter. And he said, I tried everything after getting back from Iraq. I even went to live on a Zen monastery and learned meditation there and moved to Japan to do that. And he said, I tried all these styles and I couldn't get there. I went online, I stumbled across your eco meditation online, tried it, and suddenly I was there. And so we get lots of reports like that of people just doing these simple methods, but do the science-based methods. It's really powerful to use things that the evidence shows affects your body. It's simple, there are a few of them, do those, and you don't need to go into, you know, spend, you don't need to go to Japan and join a Zen monastery for a few years.
That's what we always have fun.
And if you want to, but.
Yeah, we love Japan.
You know, I love the idea of slowing your breath. And that was one of the most important aspects for me as a meditator to get me where I needed to go. Through my yoga practice, we did an ujjayi breath and everything would slow down. When I start to channel, you can hear my breath. It's very slow. It seems like this slowing down is literally allowing you to relax. It's a full relaxation, and there's almost a surrendering of who you are as an individual, as a being, and you are allowing yourself to connect to the all. Can you explain that scientifically?
Totally.
Exactly what's going on?
We put monks and nuns into MRIs. And when you talk about that letting go of the self, coming to the present moment and connecting with something larger than yourself, we look at a brain structure called the mid prefrontal cortex. Mm-hmm. It's right between the eyes over here. It's the third eye region of the brain. And it constructs your sense of self. It's the part of you that says, oh, my name is Dawson Church. I have an interview right now. I better go pull off this ratty old t-shirt and put on a nice shirt because that's who I am. I'm a guy who wears nice shirts to interviews, not ratty old t-shirts. So I have a sense of self that is all about me. And it is very focused on looking good, presenting oneself, what is going to happen in my future, make my future good, what happened in the past that wasn't so good and how it might happen in the future and avoiding it. So the mid-prefrontal cortex builds the sense of self. In long-term meditators like these monks and nuns and in people who do eco-meditation, it's startling to watch that piece of brain tissue. It just shuts down. And so now people have no self. The parietal lobe is right around here. It locates you in space. Like right now, I'm picking up my water glass. I'm looking at you, but I'm picking up my water glass. I'm putting it down again. Didn't spill a drop. I can take a sip of water. Not looking at the glass at all. How do I do that? My parietal lobe is constructing a picture of reality outside of me. That lobe goes quiet in meditators. So now I'm no place, I'm nobody, and I'm no place. I'm drifting in time, I'm in the present moment. and you feel wonderful, then these hormones start to kick in, like serotonin and dopamine and beta endorphin and anandamide and oxytocin. You feel unconditional love, and that's oxytocin. Oxytocin is the love drug, and you feel these surges of love. So here you are, you're nobody, you're nowhere, you're no time, and you're feeling absolutely ecstatically in love. And then you start writing poetry like Rumi, or you start to have the words of St. Francis of Assisi or St. Clair or St. Teresa of Avila, and you're in this absolutely magnificent state of oneness with all that is. You've disappeared, and all there is for you is that. Then later on, you come back down to everyday reality, and you start working on your local reality. But all of these states are explainable in terms of hormones, neurotransmitters, brain structures, brain waves. We've now mapped all this out. And I wrote Bliss Brain to show people, hey, this isn't an imaginary state. And the places that the Rumis of this world go to and the St. Teresa's go to, these are not imaginary states. They are based in the brain, and you have the same tissue in your brain that Rumi had, and you can learn to activate that and go to the same place. So that's really the big clue that neuroscience is giving us right now about how these are organic states that our brains are just simply hardwired to experience and create.
Because they're, you know, like you said at the beginning when we started, right? That brain is kind of a transmitter. It's
yes.
Consciousness doesn't exist inside the brain, although there's still some materialist dead bent on making sure that it's still the worldview. You know, I'm curious, you know, when you started all of this and, you know, even before Bliss Brain, you were starting to do these clinical trials and this research was coming in. What was the biggest aha moment from the research that came through where you're like, wow? And the second thing is, did you come up against any resistance from the materialist views of science, you know, scientists and professors and academics and the medical world, the traditional medical world, as you were coming up with this material and wanting it to release to the world? Because, you know, we're in a much better place than we were, you know, 20 years ago. So we can talk about consciousness existing outside of the brain. We can even use words like non-local consciousness. 20 years ago, you might have, you know, maybe not been shot, but your career could have been ruined. So did you deal with any of those kind of touchy moments?
Well, as far as being ahas go, I find that I get ahas every day, usually after meditation. And in fact, I write about this a little bit in Bliss Brain, just a couple of paragraphs about there's the monkey mind, there's mind wandering, and that's just a challenge every meditator has to learn to overcome. But then there's also other mind wandering that happens in meditation when you get all kinds of creative ideas. And you want to learn to, what I would do when I was meditating for the first few years is I had two small pads of paper in front of me. On the left was a white pad, which had my insights. On the right was a yellow pad, which had to-dos for my work. Because I thought I would just download so many creative ideas. And I began to just really be successful at work because I was getting all these creative ideas and flashes for work. So I write down those practical things there so I wouldn't forget them. So you have insights every day. I mean, this morning in meditation, I had an insight about a problem we're working on with a big elaborate professional team, and they haven't really been able to solve it. And suddenly the solution just popped into my mind after this morning's meditation. So that's one way you get creative insights. You see yourself very differently. You see the world very differently. You see other people very differently. So all kinds of things start to shift, and creativity becomes just a foundation of your everyday life. Also disease shifts and illness shifts and misfortune shifts. And so I've had my fair share of misfortunes over the last, you know, that all those time of meditating, and everything wasn't smooth sailing in my life. But I found that I'm really resilient when those challenges happen. And then as far as the establishment people resisting, it's definitely new for them. What's really hard, I found, for establishment psychiatrists, for example, to understand is when they read the data to see how effective energy therapies are. So for example, we have a meta-analysis of EFT for PTSD. And we've now done many randomized controlled trials of treating people like women in the Congo who survived sexual assault, randomized controlled trial of EFT, with this brutalized, terrorized population. Many veteran studies, US veterans, but also like Iranian veterans. And so we have a lot of evidence showing that EFT is effective for PTSD. How effective? On the scale that is used in meta-analyses, there are three points how you measure the effectiveness of a therapy. And detectable effective treatment scores a 2 in this universally used system. A moderately effective treatment is a 5, and a highly effective treatment is an 8. So 2, 5, and 8. That's the scale we use. On that scale, in this independent meta-analysis of EFT, where EFT fell on the spectrum from 2, 5, and 8 in terms of how effective a treatment it was for PTSD was 29. So when you present this data, I mean, the data is impeccable. You can't argue with the data, but you present that to a therapist and it is so far outside of their reality picture. They've been slugging away for 35 years with veterans of the VA, seeing suicides and seeing drug overdoses and seeing broken families and homelessness and addictions. And you tell them this is that effective. It's hard for them to believe. So the old paradigm is a really hard time understanding how effective the new paradigm is at healing. But they're coming around, and you know, we're approved by the VA now. It took 10 years to get approved. I wish we'd have been approved in the first year, but we got approved in the 10th year. You just keep plugging away. And I don't find a lot of resistance. The data is just overwhelming. There are a few pockets of resistance, like there's a group of skeptics in Wikipedia who denies all the science behind acupuncture, over 1,000 studies. They just wave them all away and say, oh, it's just placebo and there's nothing there. Energy therapies, energy medicine, energy healing, they just dismiss it. So there are these pockets of people who just won't believe the science no matter how good it is. So there are a few of them.
Is that cognitive dissonance, really?
Yeah. But the data is compelling and the therapies are so good that they're taking over.
It's all of these examples too, right? When you don't want to see brown, you don't see brown. When you want to see a blue car because you're searching and purchasing a blue car, you're going to see blue cars everywhere. So it's kind of that cognitive dissonance that we can't bring it in because it's like, oh, this is our conventional view and it's our belief systems. And I've written papers on this and it's going to bring, you know, it's going to bring your identity down, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Healing is slow and hard is the way we often see it. And healing can be slow and hard, but healing, our bodies are meant to heal and our psyches are meant to heal. And it's just amazing to watch somebody, you know, like one girl, one of our volunteer groups worked with. She was in Rwanda and her parents were killed right before her eyes, hacked to death with machetes when she was 3 years old. I mean, unbelievable PTSD. Might have been an orphanage. A lot of these kids were just warehoused in orphanages. No one knew what to do with them. I mean, they were bedwetting at the age of 20. They were having nightmares and flashbacks. And then we did energy therapies with her and she just got over it. And she started her own little store, her own little commercial enterprise, and has done really well for herself financially. So you see these people who are able to heal from the most extreme of psychological and spiritual wounds. And again, in the conventional paradigm, it looks like a miracle. But energy therapies, we literally take people in. Now, not every veteran, for example, in my research, gets better.
You're talking about
EFT, yes. Yeah,
okay, in all of these cases. Not general energy practices like Reiki and...
No.
Okay.
They all have their own research base. They all have their place. But EFT is phenomenally effective for PTSD. But it works in 9 out of 10 cases, 1 out of 10 cases, nothing. We don't know why, but... So it's not like any of these are a panacea, but they're effective therapies.
So what about other traumas? We know that the California fires, you and Christine lost your house. I know I don't hate to even bring it up because I know it's a painful memory, but you know, you speak in your book about how you came through with more resilience and feeling lighter, and you actually used, you know, the therapies that you recommend to others to really get back into that state of coherence. Was there a practice that you two did as you were kind of going through that to really get to a place? Because you know, sometimes people see things like this and they'll think, Well, you know, it's easy for you guys, right? You kind of work in the field, but, you know, you don't have a kid with autism, or, you know, you didn't just, you know, lose your mother to cancer. And so sometimes people look at this and it's like, well, they don't understand our traumas.
Yeah. And we all have those in our lives. We will definitely lose our parents. My parents will definitely die. We will die for sure. Even if you have a charmed life, eventually it'll come to an end. Your body will wear out. It'll be time to dust to dust. So we're all going to have these challenges. You may have financial challenges. You may go bankrupt. You may lose your house in a housing crash. You may lose your job. You may lose your marriage. Your kids, one of your kids might not want to talk to you. I mean, all of us have problems with disease, money, career, one of these domains of life. And that's just part of the human condition. So that's where you want to be resilient. And you want to practice these skills before the bad thing happens. So when the wildfire hit and suddenly we found out, you know, we just were running out of the house as the wildfire was tearing down toward us and we drove out through the flames, we were traumatized for the first few days we were in this space. But we began to meditate in the just right away. And we found ourselves coming back to ourselves. We did EFT tapping. Friends, therapists, energy workers worked on us and helped us release the images. And even then, you know, I teach the stuff. I'm the author of the current edition of the EFT manual. And I still had one image about a year after the fire where I couldn't get this image out of my mind. And that was we had 22 people died in the fire. So there was all this death and destruction. Many of our neighbors died. I mean, they died when their garage doors wouldn't open because the power was gone, and they died because they ran back into the house to try and get a dog or a cat or something. And there are all sorts of reasons why people died in the fire. And this one image was in my mind, and I couldn't get it out. And that was as we were running from the house to the car, I wondered if I was overreacting. Am I overreacting at this threat? And at that moment, we had an office building on our property where we had our office and our whole team work. And the tree behind the office exploded into flames, and it was a classic candle shaped flame, but it was 30 feet high. And I thought to myself, rather humorously, I'm not overreacting. And we just sprinted to the car, jumped in. But that image was burned in my brain, and nothing I could do would get it out. Finally, about a year after the fire, I worked with an energy worker on that one image. It took 2 hours of therapy before I could talk about that and get through it. So you want to develop resilience, you want to use these resources. And then we were resilient. We were able to deal with that. That was just the start of our problems. I mean, we had to find a place to live. The housing market was crazy. We had a big financial crash. We lost all our money in the year after that. I had a health crisis. It wasn't pretty for us. But during that year, I wrote a new book called Bliss Brain, because I'd sit there in the morning and I'd meditate. I'd become one with the all it is. And I'd write in my journal about how inherently prosperous I was, how wonderful I felt. And, you know, it looked crazy because the external evidence wasn't there. But I know from mind to matter that you create those neural pathways in your brain, create those neural pathways, they then help you become sensitive and aware of all the opportunities out here in the outside world. So I practice these things. But again, I had 20 years of resilience, 20 years of practice. Then you built all this neural tissue in these pathways, and then it's easier. Don't wait till you're in the middle of a crisis, then try and meditate. That's hard. Wait, I mean, maybe the crisis that brings you to meditate, be grateful for that, but stick with the practice. Do it when you don't need to do it, when you aren't in crisis, because then when the crisis hits, you are one of those people who is resilient. And the data is really wonderful here. The data shows that 2/3 of people who go through that kind of a tragedy have what's called post-traumatic growth. They don't just survive. They go on to make meaning out of the experience. They use it to grow. They use it to improve their lives. 1/3 of people, same experience, lapse into all these symptoms of nightmares and flashbacks, intrusive thoughts, hypervigilance, all the symptoms of post-traumatic distress. But 2/3 of people actually are resilient. So be one of those resilient people.
Yeah, I like the idea where you say, don't wait until you have a tragedy. Getting back to the idea of coherence, that even through this, through the tragedies, it seems like you were still in a coherent state to a certain extent, even though there was these valleys and mountains sometimes, you tend to go back to that coherent state. It's almost as if you say, it's like you're going back to your breath again.
Yeah.
Yes.
So default setting after a while, and you just go there whenever you just, so you get dysregulated by things. I mean, bad things happen, but then that's your default setting. And so you automatically go back there. And after a while, meditation is you develop enough of this neural hardware to where it becomes the basic configuration of your brain. And so you're not anxious. Like, for example, for many years I had low-level anxiety, and I've worked with several friends who have low-level anxiety, and they're 60, 70 years old, and they have this low-level anxiety all the time. Mm-hmm. At a certain point, you reach the tipping point where you've built enough neural material in the four circuits I describe in this brain. You have enough neural mass there, and now your baseline is creativity, resilience, and happiness. And bad things happen, it knocks you off your perch for a little while, and then you go back there very, very quickly. Right. You correct yourself fast.
I want to ask you a question that's really kind of out there. Now, you've spoken a great deal about the science of the brain and what happens when you meditate and all of these incredible things, how you go outward and you're connecting to the all and the whatever that all is. A lot of times when we meditate, we get into this type of dream state. As if, are we here or are we not here? Where are we? Am I what I think I am? Are you Dawson? Am I Anthony? Is this Renee? Because in a meditative state, you really have no idea where you are, what you are, but you are connected to the all. So I want to ask you this particular question, this state that we're in, this being that we are,
this physical
thing that we are, is it real?
Well, the non-dualists in the Vedanta tradition, the Eastern Vedanta tradition, would say, no, it's not real. That's the only thing that's real is that that non-local consciousness. And they say that's what's really real. What's really interesting, though, is that's Vedanta teachings are thousands of years old, and they talk about the non-reality of the material body and the reality of that world of consciousness and energy. I've been working on a new book, and in the new book, I'm looking at two large data sets of people who've had many of these transcendent experiences. And what we find in those is that when they have that transformational experience, when they are one with non-local mind, one with the all that is, one with the consciousness of the cosmos, and then they come back, they describe that experience as more real than real. So subjectively, that's reality to them. And now everything around here is simply an external projection that comes from that reality, but their identity after a while is rooted in that non-local self. So you have a change in perspective. I think that the Vedantists take it a little bit too far, actually denying the reality of our physical bodies and physical existence. My personal experience is that the universe and non-local consciousness is as happy to have a local mind, body, and heart to inhabit as that mind, body, and heart is to be one with non-local consciousness. It's just a dance of a union of delight for both of those things. So my personal experience is I go out there. Now, some of the old sages, and certainly in the old monastic tradition, you went out there and you stayed out there. So 1,000 years ago, even 500 years ago, you went to the monastery, went to the convent, you did your 10,000 hours, 10 or 20 years, you learned to go out there, and you just stayed in the monastery your whole life. What I want to do is I want to come back from those states, and I want to do cool stuff in the outside world. I want to do science. I want to do experiments. I want to do social programs. I mean, our Veteran Stress Project, I started that in 2007. We treated over 22,000 veterans with PTSD free of charge. Am I excited about that? Absolutely. Is it purely on the level of material reality? Definitely. But I want to do that stuff. And if I were stuck in a monastery, you know, or in Tibet, I couldn't do all the stuff. So you want to both be in these elevated states, but then you want to come down, run a company. Be a social entrepreneur, be a fantastic father. And I'm a grandfather. I spend tons of time with my grandkids. I love being with them. I want to be a great grandfather. I want to be a great husband. I want to be a great friend to my friends. So you, this material world, I mean, when I drink wine, or when I, like my, what I made for dinner tonight is a wonderful French dish with duck and cannellini beans and all kinds of wonderful cloves, all kinds of wonderful ingredients, and I will relish each part of that. Am I going to call this non-reality and eat gruel and bread and water? No way. So it's about that. You want to embody your spirituality. The world needs embodied spirituality. Our planet is in crisis in so many ways: species extinction, global warming, climate change. We need empowered people who are here, who are in their bodies, who are effective in the material world. We don't need people who are out there. And I mean, they may be having a wonderful experience out there. And I respect those people who do go out there and did go out there. And I feel we now are called to really embody that in our local selves, in our bodies, our minds, in social projects, in our consumer habits, in our spending, in the way we, in our worldviews, and compassion for people around us. So there's a big job to do here on Earth. And denying the reality of it is not going to get us very far.
Well, that's awesome. It makes me think of two things. You know, for the fourth time, I just finished, you know, Talbot's Holographic Universe, which is now 30 years old. He brings the science and the quantum, right? Experiments from, you know, we've had quantum stuff for over 100 years now, and comes to that conclusion that it is the symbiotic dance, that this is an illusion, but that's an illusion. And it's a dance back and forth. And that dance is what allows us to materialize into physical form. And it allows the dance of the imaginal realms, or whatever you want to call it, the subtle realms, as Cynthia Bourgeau says, it allows that to exist in the ether. So that's exactly, I mean, it just reminds me of what you just said there. And then the second thing that I just would be remiss, this is the last piece of business that I had to bring up because you turned us on to it. And I would be remiss if I didn't bring it up. And that's Paul Brunton's work. That's what he spoke about. And that's what seemed to get you most excited, is that, you know, those new to Paul Brunton, he was born in 1898 in London, and you know, it was one of the first, right, in the West to bring back the stuff from the East. And wasn't that his point? Like, you know, they're off in the monasteries, but they're not coming back to this messy world. And I guess Paul Brunton had said, you know, in his Short Path book, which I couldn't put down, right, is that what's the point if you don't come back to this messy world and take all of that you've learned from these beautiful, imaginal, subtle realms, the universal consciousness, the I am consciousness, and use it here.
He was really effective in bringing these Vedanta concepts to the West, and the idea of being one with non-local mind and non-local reality. And so I then read him again a few years back, and I wanted to really make his message accessible to people. He has the 36 volumes of his work, and there are clues scattered all throughout those 36 volumes, but I put them all together in a very brief 9-month course. And so we now actually bring people into the course. They spend 9 months working with a mentor, having group meetings, and gradually we try and pry away the identity that of being just embedded in local self. And Brunton has a lot of really cool exercises that we have people do in the course. Just simple little exercises, like one of them is looking at yourself from above and shifting to a perspective above your head and looking down at your body. Simple exercise, but do it 100 times a day and you'll start to shift your consciousness. So Brunton has all of these. We package these in a really easy set of 36 milestones and exercises that you do. And if you just do these things, we find that people shift in consciousness, they start to have elevated states, they make those elevated states a habit. But the end of the Brunton material, the whole end, it's called the Short Path to Oneness, is that you've reached these states and now you're bringing it into your relationship. You're bringing it into your diet. You're bringing it into your exercise routine. You're bringing it into your work. You're bringing it into your volunteering in your community. You're bringing it into the way you spend money and think about money. So it's powerful the way Brunton does that. You do go out there, and the whole middle part of the Brunton non-dual experience is pretty, I mean, there are some pretty weird states of consciousness you get into there. But if you keep on moving through them, you then get to the point where you're embodying that and you're effective in being those values, but now at the level of local mind. And so you begin in local mind, you end in local mind. But in the meantime, between those two points, you have this experience and you bring all of that elevated functioning down to the level of your local functioning. And it transforms everything around you. You live life with so much pleasure. You do smell that flower and you extract that delightful experience from everything around you. My wife, when she walks through a rose garden, it takes her a while because she wants to smell every rose bush and she'll linger on each one. Now, I would just walk through intent on my goal with Christine. I just spend half an hour walking 10 yards. And it's just wonderful to do that, to slow down and really savor the world around us. We live in a beautiful world. We have these amazing bodies, and to enjoy your body, enjoy the bodies and the hugs and the love of people around you, to enjoy money, to have this thing called money to be able to create with is powerful. So your life at the local level, once you finish the short path and you are embodied, is one of service and one of delight, one of enjoyment, and one of unimaginable pleasure every single day. And that's really the birthright of every human being. We all have this ability. We all have those structures in our brain, these circuits that allow us to connect and then to embody it and manifest it around us. Most of us just aren't using those circuits. And so my passion right now is saying, hey, you got this hardware in your brain. It's going to take you to ecstasy, bring you back down and make you productive and creative. Turn it on and use it.
That is such a great way to end, isn't it? Like, turn it on.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, and especially to hear you laugh. Laugh is contagious, because when you laugh, it makes everyone feel good about themselves and about where they are in this lifetime. So thank you for all the work that you do, and to bring together the science and the meditation, and to show people that there really is something to meditation, and that it really does change the structures of your brain, which in fact change the structures of your DNA, and really do allow you to connect to something greater than yourself and bring happiness to yourself. Mm. You all want to be happy.
Yeah, it's a joy to be doing this work and to be connecting with people like you, connecting with all people of goodwill all over the world. And we are this resonant community. And even though there's misery and suffering and there's a lot of this turmoil in the world, there's always been turmoil in the world. There always will be turmoil in the world. And as part of this healing community, we have a wonderful ability to have an effect on those around us. And so we want to just be in that space, meditate, but then go out, do our thing. And then we genuinely can be effective in the world around us and make a huge difference. So I know the world's going to shift for the positive dramatically just in the next year, in the next decade, in the next 30 years. There are so many positive trends I cover at the end of this brain, all these ways in which human life and the world is, we're making the world a better place by being this community. So it's a thrill to be part of it. And I look forward to the ride ahead.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, the shift, the consciousness project where people are all meditating or praying or, just intending positive and good in the world, whether it's the environment, what's happening in the Ukraine right now with Afghanistan. I mean, all of these things are collective consciousness together. When we focus on the positive and the good and the beauty, then we can actually implement change that's sustainable. So with that, we thank you so much for joining us. And in the subsequent pages, we will be posting links to find out about all of your work, everything that you're involved in. And by the way, I just discovered, and I've known you for a while, I just discovered that there's actually a place on Dawson's website that you can click and hear his laugh.
There is.
Thank you for your energy, your love, and you know, your work and contribution to the scientific community and bridging the gap between science, spirituality, and consciousness, right? And the awareness of who we are in this lifetime.
Yep, we're all in this together. Thank you.
We are all
Thank
this you. Together. Oh, yay. Big hearts, big hearts, big love.
As yeah.
Greek always says, big love. So with that, Om Shanti Shanti.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
You've been listening to Blue Soul Chats, a podcast that bridges science and spirituality. You can learn more about our work at bluesoulearth.com, studywithspirit.com, and bluesoulmedia.com.
Also, head over to bluesoulsummit.com, where you can watch video interviews, each season tackling a particular topic. We are also at Blue Soul Earth on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and Clubhouse.
Join us for a future episode of Blue Soul Chats, where we hope to ignite your soul's journey, expand your awareness, and deepen your consciousness.
Thanks for being here, and don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and listen to previous episodes in our library.